Steve Geyer is a comedian, and he's author of a brand new book called Shameless. Here's what a pastor of discipleship from Panama City, Florida, said about the book. He said, "Steve, I'm sitting in a questionable car wash in a less than desirable neighborhood and reading your book for the third time. The, quote, ugly cry that happened with the first two readings has surfaced again and is scaring my fellow patrons. Thank you for your candor and transparency." And this, from Steve Geyer's website, it's apparently the first review of the book on Amazon, because it's obviously available there. And here's what the author of this response said. "Humbled, that's the first word that comes to mind after reading this wonderful book. I must admit initially that I had bought the book because of the admiration I have for Steve as an entertainer. I can see now I was led to this book for God's purposes, and while it won't solve my problems, it did give me a great place to start and to recognize my own shame. Kudos to Steve for the courage to, number one, get through his own shame, and number two, write the book to help others. So if you buy this book expecting to laugh a minute, it's not there. There are some, hey, he's a comedian, but it's an eye-opener that can help." So that's a pretty powerful endorsement for the book from the first to respond on Amazon. Steve Geyer, the author and comedian, joins us on Lifeline. What's up, man?
The author, that still cracks me up.
Isn't that wild?
I got introduced that way the other day. I was at an event with Gary Thomas, who's written more than 20 books. And yeah, it was just funny when they said, "And author and comedian Steve Geyer." And I kind of like winced at it. And Gary Thomas was really nice. He said, "Hey, man, you're an author now, man. Just lean into it." Yes, sir. So anyway, yeah, man, it was never intended to be a book. It was a blog that kind of grew into a three-year journey. And
I got to tell you about a vivid memory I have where you've traveled around with a number of guys who speak, and obviously through the ministry of funandfaith.ca. But
right.
Okay, so we were in Oshawa at Embassy Church. It's where I kind of got reacquainted with you there, and Gary Chapman was speaking at that event. But that day I had you on the air, you know, like during the afternoon prior to the event, and you started talking about these issues.
Yeah, I remember.
And so this was like, the book was probably just getting started at that point. Now it's in print, now it's available, and it's kind of cool that we get a chance to talk about it on Lifeline. By the way, you mentioned Gary Thomas. We've been talking about it a lot here because he's going to be doing two dates in Buffalo that you'll be at.
Yeah. I'll be with him there. Yeah, absolutely.
And then two
he's
more in
really
Toronto.
Good. Yeah, it's funny. Recently the passing of Gary Smalley, which was sad, but I've been able to do events with Gary Smalley, Gary Chapman, now Gary Thomas. So from now on, anybody that wants to use me as an opening act or to work with, if your name's not Gary, I don't see it. I just don't think it's the Lord. So
it's got to be so confusing.
What's funny, Neil, is that you're the first. You were the first person I ever talked to about it publicly, and I remember, and you and I having a conversation afterwards, mm-hmm. and it was fun to get caught back up with you after all those years, because I took a hiatus from doing stand-up for about 15 years, but I remember that conversation distinctly, and I remember you saying, "Hey, if you get this done, I'd like to talk to you about it." It still kind of amazes me that it's done, and I didn't do anything. It was all done. There were people that had read it, encouraged me, and it's the one project that I really just I didn't push any buttons, pull any strings. I wrote this thing, and then other people just found the merit in it, and that it helped them. In fact, my first editor was extremely encouraging. She mm-hmm. was just she was like, keep writing, and. And along the way, I had a few people read it here and there, and they would just say, "You're putting into words how I feel," and that's the whole point of the book, is that it's not a how-to book. It's not a "this will solve all your problems." It's about putting words on how people are feeling, and then dealing with some things, cultural things that kind of are acceptable, the acceptable shame in our culture that is anything but healthy. So, it's been quite a journey, man. It took me a total of 3 years to do it.
Wow. What's really interesting about the cover of the book is it's a picture of you taking off a mask.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talk about that all the time here on Lifeline. We have a lot of returns coming back from commercial breaks that talk about, hey, where else can you take off the mask and talk about what's really going on in your life except places like this? Because, mm-hmm. Because issues that we're ashamed about, or that if we feel a sense of shame, if there's habits or struggles we're having, we don't often talk about that stuff in the lobby at church.
No.
So, you know, there's got to be a safe place to discuss this kind of stuff. And I'm just grateful that you've decided to tell some of your own story in this book, because I believe it's going to be liberating. When somebody finally opens up, it usually opens the floodgate for others to say, as you just indicated, man, Steve,
yeah,
you're putting into words how I feel.
Yeah, I tell you, Neil, it's been the emails that I've gotten on this, you know, are, some of them are just kind of gut-wrenching. People saying, you know, I have suffered with this my whole life, and I didn't realize what it was. And then other ones were, you know, and to be real honest, what was funny was as I was writing it, the first two editors I had were both ladies who both knew me and were kind of sympathetic to the material. And then the final editor with the publisher was a guy that I didn't know. And I thought, wow, somebody who doesn't know me, and it's a guy, you know, is this going to resonate with a man? Because sometimes as men, we're taught culturally, you know, don't share your feelings or whatever. And he really got it, and he understood. I mean, he picked up very quickly the purpose of the book, the intent, what I was trying to communicate and everything. He was very good at helping me say it a little bit more clearly, because as a comic, you know, I use timing to communicate. But what has really surprised me is the emails that I'm getting back from men, in particular fathers, who say, wow, I'm a mess reading this, because I'm realizing how I've been treating my children. And it's just so convicting. And so that was like, you know, a real kind of cathartic thing for me, that
sure,
what helped me. And again, it's not I'm not standing on this podium going, here's what you do. I detail mistakes that I made, things that I learned about shame, things that I learned about sarcasm. There's a whole chapter on sarcasm that, you know, I had several people, their common comment is, when I first started reading this, I thought, oh man, I like sarcasm. Sarcasm's funny. I think it's cool. And then by the end of the chapter, they're like, you know, they're gutted. They're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize. So it's really been very comforting to know that it's helping people, you know. I had coffee with a guy today who came back. He said, I'm going to buy some books from you and hand them out. And I was like, are you serious? He said, yeah. And in particular, he brought up the chapter on sarcasm, and he goes, I have guarded my lips now like I've never done it before. And I said, well, cool, man. I said, I think that's great. So, you know, I'm still kind of blown away at the response to the book, because it does seem to be helping people. And like you were saying, you know, you and I were talking, you know, privately after that initial interview, that how you and I both had dealt with shame in our lives, and mm-hmm. how it almost crippled us, and from living a life full, the full life that Jesus calls us to. So,
right.
Yeah,
right,
man, it's intense.
Some may have just tuned in. They hear that you've written a book called Shameless, and we talk about this word shame. And for those who've never really understood what the kind of shame you're talking about, they've never really gotten the fuller picture of what shame can look like. They might say, well, okay, if you rob a bank and you get arrested, you should be ashamed of yourself, right? There's maybe a good sense of shame, but that's not what we're talking about here. And
no,
you know, can you
right.
define
In fact,
that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the word, the correct word we should feel is sorrow, not shame. Shame mm-hmm. is something, again, even in the way, let me give you an example. Words don't mean anything anymore, like the word awesome. How many times have you heard somebody say, wow, this pizza's awesome? Mm-hmm. Well, if by definition that were true, you couldn't eat the pizza, because also means to be in reverential awe or to have your breath taken away. So if someone says, man, this pizza is awesome, then everybody would be falling on the ground incapable of approaching the pizza because of its awesomeness.
Right.
So I use that as an example of when we say, "Oh, you should be ashamed of yourself." No, you should have godly sorrow. Mm-hmm. Shame is what the world, you know, shame doesn't lead us to Jesus. Godly sorrow does, and that's the thing, that it's that sorrow. It's that place of, "Wow, I am sorry for what I did." If I am ashamed, ashamed means to cover up. It means that as long as I'm ashamed of this, I will cover it up. But if I'm sorrow, if I'm sorry for it, I will seek to be redeemed, or seek forgiveness. I will seek restitution. But as long as I am ashamed, I am not going to come forward. It's like a bedwetter. How many people go, you know, yeah, man, I'm a bedwetter. That, you know, that's something that you're ashamed of.
Right.
It's when you want to hide that. You don't want to tell anybody I wet the bed. But it's when you go to somebody and say, as embarrassing as this is, you know, I'm speaking as a child, you know, for a child who has trouble wetting the bed, to say I wet the bed. I had a cousin who wet the bed for the longest time, and he lived in this. He would get up and he'd wash his sheets and try to do all this stuff to cover it up instead of saying, I have this problem, I keep wetting the bed, and then going to see a doctor to go, oh, here's what your problem is. So a lot of times people suffer under shame because they're covering up. It's when you go in and say, I want this off of me. And that's the point that I try to make repeatedly throughout the book, because, yeah, some people go, well, isn't there a healthy kind of shame? I haven't been able to find it. I just have not found it. I have found that it's sorrow. It's sorrow. It's being sorrowful that leads me to repentance. Shame, again, and again, not to overemphasize it, but really kind of help us understand that certain words don't mean what we think they mean. Again, like awesome. This pizza is not awesome. It's good, and I like it, but it doesn't make me fall down in reverential awe.
But now, even on the bedwetting example's a wonderful example, because I wet the bed till I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I wanted to cover that up. It was not so easy to do at summer camp, by the way.
Yeah, no, right. And then the fear, then to think about the fear of that, the apprehension of that, going to bed was terrifying.
Right.
I don't want to go to sleep. What happens, you know? And so that shame impacted not only your mornings, but it impacted you going to bed, because that apprehension of, oh gosh, what if, right? So yeah, and I think about, like, when someone says to a kid, shame on you, I'm like, I kind of wince, and as I say in the book too, I'm not the verb, you know, the word police, you know, when I hear people say things, when I hear people being sarcastic or whatever,
right.
You know, it's not up to me to straighten them out, but to live my life in a way that I don't employ sarcasm anymore. I try to stay away from shaming things, even a look. One of the emails I got from a dad who said, I unintentionally shame my son because I roll my eyes, and I'm telling him, you know, I'm not approving of you. And he said, man, it just really, you know, he said, because he's sarcastic in his treatment of one particular child in his family. And mm-hmm. the thing that really blows me away is the detail by which people are communicating to me, the emails that I'm getting, these, like, things that they're telling me that they've never told anyone. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes my breath away, like, oh my gosh, you know. And these are grown-ups, these are people my age,
right.
You know, people who have suffered under this cloud of shame for years and years and years, and now they're like, gosh, I'm finally free. So it's really prevalent, and I'm sure there are some people who will read the book. Like, I had one friend who was reading the book, and it was kind of funny, because I said, I just want your thoughts on this. And they came back and said, well, you know, it's good. It doesn't apply to me. And then, like, a day or two later, I get an email, forget what I said, I'm a puddle. And later on, I got another email that said, hey, I'm almost done. I was so detached from this book, and then the chapter on, there was, I forgot which chapter it was, that kind of turned the corner for them. They're like going, oh my gosh, I've got unrecognized shame in my life that I didn't even realize that I had. So it's like, wow, you know, because, you know, my supposition at the beginning of the book is that, hey, look, this isn't going to apply to everybody, but it'll probably apply to somebody that you know. And so far, everything I've gotten back is like, no, nah, me too. So,
what I was going to say, though, even like the bedwetting example still has to do with a behavior, in a sense that somebody might say, well, okay, if I could just stop wetting the bed, I wouldn't have any need to be ashamed. But
right.
isn't there a kind of shame that just fundamentally says, I'm a bad person, I'll never measure up, I'm unacceptable? And it isn't necessarily tied to a particular behavior, it's just a lie that we believe.
It is. It's a lie that I'm acceptable, that I'm there's something innately wrong with me, and I'm going to either check out from life or I'm going to outrun. You know, I'm going to outrun my shame. That's mm-hmm. that success that people achieve, or, you know, or they try to medicate it through a variety of things, or they just curl up in a ball, and I'm worthless. And a lot of codependents are deal with shame because they in my years as a pastor, one of the things in dealing with codependence and in some of my own codependency, it was we will tend to put up with really bizarre and inappropriate behavior in other people that we would never accept in ourselves. Well, why? Because other people are better than us, that we are innately or inherently flawed, and kind of one of the things I refer to as that, you know, I'm the booby prize, you know, I'm the also-ran, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how it doesn't, it is, Neil, it's a mindset, it's a belief system that I am unlovable, I am unworthy, I'm all these things. And so it is the biggest hurdle to accepting the gospel. And the biggest, for me, the biggest piece of embracing the gospel is really understanding forgiveness. And until a person really can receive and understand what forgiveness is and embrace it, that I have been forgiven, shame will always have the upper hand, because it's like this too. I can't fully forgive. I mean, I don't know how anybody can forgive without first being forgiven. I mean, how do you export something that you don't possess? So those are some of the other things that, you know, we deal with in the book, of how to, you know, what does it mean to forgive, and how do we do this, and all that. And but like I said, in our conversation, it was we were kind of you know finishing each other's sentences that day before the Chapman event. So and it's funny, because I remember that day distinctly. It was kind of at a crucial time. I don't know if I told you this, but I went through a real deep depression at one point, where my editor even said, I've been praying for you, because I was wondering when what you were writing was going to hit you. You almost seemed detached from it. And I was, at some level. I was kind of like, oh, I'm over it, you know. But then it hit me at another level.
Right.
But I remember when I was talking to you, that, and your response to me was one of the key things that kept me engaged in writing, because you know, that would have been a year ago, November.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't easy, man. That was, or what was that? Yeah, it was a year ago.
Yeah,
November,
yeah. Almost a year and a half ago now.
Yeah, but, right. And then that following, yeah, and that was when I was coming out of that depression. So, yeah, so, there you go.
You know, I just got to say that I don't remember everything that I said to you exactly. I remember the nature of the conversation and some of the things we discussed, but here's the thing. It wasn't hard to respond, or I wasn't having to make that stuff up, because what you were saying to me was, you already mentioned this, but it was resonating. Like, I knew the language you were speaking.
Yeah, and I think that's for you, that it was resonating with you, but for me, that I'm not just on a rabbit trail here, that this thing that I'm talking about, because it, in some level, you know, I was actually almost ready to delete the whole thing. I just thought, this is stupid. Why am I doing this? And then I realized that's the power of shame. I was like, I'm embarrassed of what I've written. This stinks. This isn't going to help anybody. And the whole point of the book was to help people. It wasn't to, you know, I'm never going to get rich on this book. I'm not a known author. I'm a comic, for goodness sake. So the intent of the book was always, it was a blog to help people, and it's transitioned from a blog to a book. But again, that's the power of shame, how it works, that I'm even in the middle of it, I'm talking with you in a conversation just with you, that it resonated with you, helped me overcome another layer of shame that I was dealing with. So it's a process, man. I will, you know, all I need is a few negative reviews to, you know, allow shame to come knocking on my door going, you're an idiot, you know, see what you did, you know. So I, yep. And I had to prepare. My wife and I talked about that. My kids, my son asked me the other day, he said, Dad, what are you going to do when you get a negative review? And I said, well, I've prayed about it. And I said, I addressed it in the book that I know I'm setting myself up for it. You know, there's some people, there's trolls, you know, Twitter trolls and all that. People are just going to say whatever. Right. You know, I've just got to guard my heart and say, you know, I didn't write this to be provocative. I wrote it to help. And right. So, but, you know, I mean, that's, you know, even thinking about what you do for a living, if someone, I mean, you're out there. I mean, people think what you do is easy, but it's not. What you do is extremely difficult. You have to watch your words. You have to be this and that. And everybody's so easily offended these days that if you are easily wounded, you couldn't do your job, you know, because every day, even though you have no intention to, and when you look at it, you didn't really offend anybody, but someone took offense. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the strength and the calling and the invitation from God to do what you do, you'd curl up in a ball too. So it's, you know, people think, oh, I could be on the radio. It's like, no, you can't. It takes a special person to do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do what you do every day. I couldn't do it. So I think that's something too that I'm hoping will help people in their daily lives, what they do for a living, that when they get criticized or someone takes offense at something that they didn't mean or that they didn't intend, that they won't get shame on them. Because once you're kind of a recipient of shame and kind of it's real sticky, once you're good at taking it on, you're just a master at piling it on. So it's something that you have to continually have your guard up that, no, I'm not going to let this come back on me. So,
all right.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let me ask you then, if you don't mind, how shame has impacted your own life. Now, I've heard some of the story, and we don't need to go into all the details per se, but whatever you're comfortable talking about, because obviously this book is about your own journey to find freedom from shame.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, it was introduced to me in successive ways through some were family structure. When I was in school, it was interesting, in my second grade class way back when, I was the only kid in my class whose parents were divorced. I was the only kid, which is sounds kind of crazy these days, but I was the only kid that didn't have a dad. And so there was a little bit of a kind of weirdness there, where there was the father and son. They had a lot of father and son things then, you know, and didn't have that. We were relatively poor. We lived in the projects for many years. And so there was the shame with no dad, the shame of, you know, poverty and different things. And then when I was in the second grade, I was molested by a man, and that added to it too. So there was this, what's kind of wrong with me? And what happened was, is I was one of those people that tried to overcome it, and just kind of like, I just, to be included, was so desperate to be included that I ended up, oftentimes as a kid, I would talk before I thought, you know, just impulsively. And one of the things, just, you know, there was no intention to do me harm. It was just meant to be in good fun. But it backfired when I said something one time to some, in front of some, was with family and somebody I really looked up to. And I inherited the moniker Dumb Steve. And that became my nickname, Dumb Steve, Dumb Steve, Dumb Steve. And so I started to believe that, and how it impacted me was, I also had ADHD as a kid. Didn't know what that was. You know, I was like, you know, my report cards were always, you know, could do so much better. You know, but it was when I was in high school. I was a sophomore in high school. I was in remedial math. I was in basically a special ed class for mathematics, and I took my test up and handed it to the teacher. And I went back and sat down, and then a few minutes later, she said, Stephen, come up here. So I walked up to her desk, and I was, teachers frightened me anyway. And so I was kind of apprehensive, and I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, what are you doing in my class? And my first response was the shame. I got really defensive. You know, I started sweating. I said, I wasn't cheating, because I had been looking around. And the reason I was looking around was, why aren't they finished? Why, that test was really easy. Why is everybody still taking the test? And I said, why? I said, I wasn't cheating. She goes, oh, no, sweetheart. She goes, your test is right here in front of me. She goes, I want to, what are you doing in my class? And I said, what do you mean? She said, why are you in remedial math? And I said, because I'm stupid. And her eyes watered up. And I'll never forget this. This is like yesterday for me, and I'm 57 years old, so it's been a while since I was a sophomore in high school. She teared up. She said, oh, no, sweetheart, you're not. She goes, you got 100. You got, you know, and, I mean, I finished this test very quickly. She goes, you got the whole, she said, you got the bonus question and everything. And, I mean, I'm like, you know, trying to catch my breath because I'm starting to get emotional, you know, and that's not cool when you're, you know,
it's not
in high school, you know. And so I'm standing there, and she said, why aren't you in Algebra 2? And I said, well, because I'm stupid. And I said, she said, what do you mean? I said, I just can't do algebra. And she said, I'll never forget this, Neil. She said, you can't do algebra or you never taught algebra. And it was at that time when, you know, and my mother was a school teacher. I have admiration and highly respect and revere school teachers. I wanted to be one. That's what I was going to be before I went into stand-up. Mm-hmm. But some teachers, they're the kind that make the test so hard you can't pass it, and then some that they just don't want to teach anymore. They just, you know. And so I had my algebra teacher never really taught me algebra. Just kind of, you know, you had to learn at her pace, or you were in trouble. Mm-hmm. So this teacher sat there and she did an equation. She said, "This is this. This is this. This is this. This is this and this and this." She goes, "Okay, now you do one." And so I did it. And she jumped up from her chair and grabbed me and hugged me. And she said, see, you're not stupid. This is great. You're so smart, blah, blah, blah. And I lost it. I mean, I'm just crying like a baby. You know, all these other kids are looking at me like, what's wrong with that guy, you know? And she got me out of her class and got me into Algebra 2, like, overnight. And what was crazy was that I had believed that I was stupid because of the shame of dumb Steve talking, saying things before I really thought it through, trying to be funny, trying to be, you know, part of the conversation, mm-hmm. that something as simple as, here comes dumb Steve, well, when you add up to the fact that I was embarrassed and had to hide the fact, like, I used to make up stories about my dad. This is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I didn't write about this in the book. But there was one time where I stood up in front of a, you know, you had to do kind of like the, you know, the, you had to share something, you know, and whatever. And I remember telling this elaborate story about my dad that was a total lie. And the teacher knew that I was not telling the truth. And she just let it go on. And then later came to me and said, Stephen, you don't have a dad, do you? And I was like, no, ma'am. And, you know, and it was like, oh, I can't believe I just got up in front of my classmates and did that. But because I wanted to project something, and that's why people wonder, well, how did you do comedy? That's how. I so desperately wanted, I wanted affirmation more than I feared rejection. And that's, to this day, people are like, how did you do stand-up? How did you do that? Simply put, I wanted affirmation more than I feared rejection. And I would seek it that way. So it's amazing how it controlled me for years and years and years and years. And even doing stand-up in the early days was me trying to outrun shame, that I matter, that I'm good enough, that I'm, you know, I belong here, even though there were nights when I was on stage and people paid money to come see me, Neil, I would sit there thinking, why would anybody pay money to come hear me? And, you know, that's when I had records out, you know, I'm selling records and, you know, I don't know how many people get to say this, but DC Talk used to open for me back when they were college boys, you know?
Yeah.
And, that's kind of funny, you know? And, so, you know, that's how powerful it is. And and there, you know, I go into other stories in the book about that. And but yeah, it's you know I've discussed again privately, you know, the power of this stuff. And
right.
once it starts coming off, there's no feeling like it in the world, and you want it all off. Then it's like, it's for me, it's if anyone's ever read the Chronicles of Narnia, it's that place where Eustace finally realizes that he wants the dragon skin off. If you read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it's in that story where Eustace has an encounter with a dragon, and it's that kind of, I want this off of me. I don't want to be a dragon anymore.
How did this, and I know how I would talk about it if it was me here, but how did your battle with this sense of shame affect your understanding of God? How did it affect your role as a husband or father? You know, that kind of stuff.
Just, you know, it's a holistic thing. I mean, shame, it's like this whole, it's like a coat. One of the things I talk about is this iron coat that you just learn to wear. You learn to, it's kind of like wearing leg weights that never come off. You know, it's like sometimes when you're training, you put on leg weights or things, you put on, you know, weighted things that will help you so that when you take them off, you feel free. Well, that feeling of freedom never came. It was always, even through hearing the gospel, there was a somewhat of an understanding, but there was always this, but I'm not good enough. I'm still that guy that, man, if anybody's ever going to do everything they're supposed to do and still go to hell, that's me, you know. And the other part of it was that I never felt like I could measure up as a dad. And with my daughter, it was a little bit easier. But with my son, I was always like, I didn't know what to do because I thought, wow, how am I going to be a dad to a boy? And so there was a lot of head games that were going on. There were things that I put on myself that was really unnecessary. I mean, so it was like these leg weights to make up. I kept adding and adding and adding and adding, and I really never understood that they could come off. And because at some level I felt like I deserved it, that inherently there was something wrong with me. One of the things too, it's in your psyche. One thing that I forgot to mention too was that my mother, you know, God love her, she had no, she battled her own shame, and what she never realized was, and she never meant to do this, but this is the power of words. Mm-hmm. She would say something like, "I've had 11 years of pure hell." Well, what she was talking about was that my father had left, and so for 11 years, her life was turned upside down. Mm-hmm. But coincidentally, I was 11 years old. So whenever she would say, "I've had 10 years of hell," "I've had 13 years of nothing but hell," well, I equated, "It's me, it's me, it's me, it's me," right?
Right.
So then what happened was I tried to, as a parent, overcome that where I couldn't, you know, I was going to be so careful with my children that sometimes I got too careful. Like, you know, there were times when I probably should have been more, you know, more stern. I was more easygoing and everything. And then I'd get upset, and then I'd get frustrated, and then I'd get really angry with them. And it was like, wow, if I had just had a healthy response to, you know, bad behavior,
right,
you know, before, you know, I would just let it go. I'd let it go, let it go, let it go. And then I'd finally like get all frustrated about it. But, and I was a stuffer, how shame impacted me too. My children can tell you they can count on less than one hand the number of times they've ever heard me raise my voice. I'm just not a yeller. I'm not a shouter. I just don't do it. But when I did, it was like the lid came off, you know? And so, that's how it impacted me as a parent. It had me just stuff things because I was so afraid that I was going to damage my children, mm-hmm, that I wasn't going to parent them in a healthy way. And that went on for a long time. But again, God is amazing. I mean, it's funny. My daughter told me the other day, she loves the book. She cried. She said, "Daddy, this is such a good book." But she said, which was, I thought was really sweet, she said, "That I had the best childhood of anybody." She goes, you know, she goes, I hear what you're saying, but I had a great childhood. And so I'm like, I'm so grateful for selective memory, you know.
Yeah.
So she, it was great that my kids knew my heart. They could tell the intent of Daddy's heart, even though I'm much more harder on myself than my children would be. But yeah, it's the thing too. Here's something that, what shame did for me, and this is a very vulnerable thing, and for anybody who's listening, this is like down to the bone of it. When you are told repeatedly that if you were abused or if you were sexually molested as a child, that you will pay it forward. Now, there are stats that say there's a high probability that could happen, but it's not 100%. And so for a long time, I was afraid to hold my children, you know, and you know, I would hold them publicly and everything. Mm-hmm. But there was this thing in the back of my head that the shame of, you know, I might do this. And that robbed me of being able to freely hold my children, knowing that I would never do anything like that. But there was this thing in the back of my head, what if? And that's where shame really robbed me for many years of just being able to not have to think about that. And that's that covering up part that you and I were talking about earlier, that it's like, you know, just the thought that I could do anything to my children just was crippled me. And that's one of the other unintended consequences of shame that people don't talk about. It's the what it robs from you in your life. You know, like I can't even have the freedom to hold my children without fear. So that was and again that's another reason why I wrote the book, so people could be free from that kind of nonsense.
Interesting, and we won't have to belabor this or my own story or what I'm about to tell you, but I couldn't hug anyone till almost the age of 30. And you know, based on a very similar past, similar story. But I also was speaking with a woman who was abused as a child just recently. She actually just popped into the station, and she's somebody that we knew from previous conversations about sexual abuse. And she told me that she couldn't hold her own child. She couldn't nurse or hold her own baby as a result of what she'd been through. Now, she's gone through a tremendous amount of healing and is experiencing freedom today and is able to love her children as she should. But just think about how crippling all of that can be. And obviously, if that's some of what you struggled with growing up, you know, the enemy would love to hold that over your head and, you know, Steve, you could have been a better father. You could have been more affectionate with your own children. But obviously, God's grace is sufficient. And based upon your daughter's reaction to you the other day, you know.
Yeah, and what was great was even, you know, early on, I pushed through it. I pushed through the shame where I was very affectionate with my kids and everything, because I thought I'm going to, just kind of like the comedy side of, I'm going to beat this thing, and no, you're not, you know, and I took a proactive approach. But the thing was for me is that, but the thought, that what it robbed for me is the joy in not even having to think about it, and that woman, to hear that just so breaks my heart, but I understand it, and could say to her, oh, darling, I know exactly how you feel, and I'm very fortunate that I was able, though, to hold my kids and all that in a very appropriate, godly, fatherly way. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, the battle was in my head, and it's sad, you know, and that's, you know, that's for the wages of sin is death. That's a kind of a death that, you know, I know that scripture means it's the separation of God. There's also, you know, this, it's the walking dead.
Right.
You know, there are people who it's spiritually, emotionally walking dead there among us.
Mike, thanks for holding. You've got obviously a question or a comment you wanted to share with Steve.
Steve, yes. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say I just found the station and I'm totally hooked on it, and I have it on constantly. And I think God works, you know, this is how God works. I'm listening to the station on my way home from work, and when this gentleman started talking about, and he's talking about shame, and he's talking about, you know, him writing a book, and I mean, I did the same thing, and I'm not going to discuss my book. It took me 3 years to write. It was about shame. It's, you know, and I'm thinking, what kind of shame was he talking about? You know, I'm waiting, and I just got that, and it's a very similar situation, but my shame was, you know, it was more like afraid to expose myself to guilt, and what would the repercussions be? And I lived with it for 47 years. I was silent, and I know what he's saying when you have to carry that weight with you, and you can't release it. Well, one day I sat down and I wrote the book, and I know when he had mentioned about, you know, releasing it, or do I throw it away? Because you know, I did the exact same thing, and I can so much relate to that feeling of shame and guilt, and you know, because mine was similar. Mine was sexually, you know, physically, emotionally. It was all, you know, that's what I was wondering what he was getting at, and I totally agree with everything he's saying. It's just amazing how God works.
Yeah, interesting. And Mike, thank you for sharing that. Steve, how much therapy, put it in quotes, how much therapy did writing the book and writing the blog provide you, and or was that the source of your healing, or did it actually begin earlier? You know, were you getting healed before you started writing, I guess, is a question.
Well, it was, and I really appreciate Mike for sharing that, because he'll be able to probably attest to this too, and his probably his journey on this. It was something that I was writing because I had recognized it and was healing from it and everything, and so I started writing this blog about it. And what happened was is I couldn't finish it. It wasn't that I didn't have material. I had too much material, and so as I kept writing it, the editor was like, "Hey, you know, are you going to submit your blog?" And I said, "I can't finish it." And she said, "Do you need more material?" I said, "No, I've got too much." I said, "I can't stop. Every time I go to close it, let me say one more thing. Let me say one more thing." So she said, "Well, keep writing it, and just, you know, we'll just, you know, do a different blog for this month, but just keep writing it." So I kept writing it and writing it, and she said, "Well, send me what you have." And then as I started sending it to her, she was like, "Oh my gosh, you got to keep writing this, you know." So it was stuff that I was already working through, and then halfway through the project, and it was after I saw you, because I was trying to think about it. Mm-hmm. It was after I saw you in November that I hit the depression, because that's when, and what happened was, and this is what, and again, you know, I wonder if this resonates with Mike as well. What had happened was, as I was writing this stuff, and it didn't bother me. Like, it's some of the stuff that I was writing, and she was like, "Wow, this is so powerful." And I almost felt detached from it. I felt like, okay, you know, because I'd lived it, and because I had at a certain level worked through some forgiveness and everything. And then I bottomed out, and it was January of 2015 that I bottomed out, and I just kind of, I stopped answering my phone. I stopped writing. I wanted to delete the thing. And that's when intercessors really took over. My wife especially just started praying for me, and they were like, "Okay, something's going on." And it started to hit me. And so the book, the blog was an attempt to help people with it, because here's what I've been learning. But then I went through another layer of this deeper, wow, this is really what this is, and this is how it impacted me. And I went back, and here's the funny thing, you know, I rewrote almost the entire book, and here's why. I told the editor, I said, when I went back and read this, I said, do I sound angry to you in this book? She said, "No, not at all." And I said, "It sounds angry to me." And I said, "I know me. To me, it sounds angry." And she goes, "I don't think it sounds angry, but if you want to rewrite it, you go ahead, but I'm going to keep both drafts." And I said, "Okay." So in the second draft, when I wrote it, she came back and said, "I really like," she said, "I like them both, but I like the second one better." So that's what the writing process did for me, is it helped me, and again, this may resonate with Mike, the book helped me lift off the last part, which was the anger. Mm-hmm. Because when I had shame, I didn't realize that I had any right to be angry. The Bible doesn't say not be angry, and people say, "Oh, you know, don't be angry." No, it says be angry and sin not. Ephesians 4 talks about get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger. Well, that anger means that anger of basically not getting my way. It's not about if someone hurts you or someone damages your spouse or your children that you don't get angry with them. It's just this anger of not getting your own way. And so as Christians, what we do in the church, and that's why I laugh so hard, what about you tapping your foot, you know, inside your legalistic loafer there? We're not allowed to be honest. We're not allowed to be angry. We're not allowed to have human emotions. And that's exactly what Jesus wants. But, you know, we can be angry and sin not. I'm sure he was pretty angry when he was flipping those tables over. So one of the things that I think Mike steered into as well, part of that coat or that weight or those leg weights that you can never take off is, that this kind of anger at yourself and this anger at God, that, you know, even though who am I to be angry at God, it's in there. So, and I hope that makes sense. I hope that answers the question you're asking. But I wrote the book to help people through shame that I was being healed from, but writing the book took me to another level.
How you doing, Jeff? And thanks for holding.
You're welcome. Thank you, Neil.
Yeah, what's up?
Can you hear me all right?
We got you. Yeah, what's on your heart?
Well, it's on my heart is to thank you. I love listening to your show, and I was glad to hear you coming back. I love WDCX. WDCX has helped shape my Christian walk amazingly. And I really wanted to thank Steve today for writing that book. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I was just coming out of work, and then I heard your show. And shame is definitely at the core of a lot of issues that I've experienced in my life. I'm also an adult who has gone through that awful trauma as a child. And I actually got to become a registered social worker and work with a lot of people going through sexual abuse, either being offenders or being abused. And I heard you talking as I came out of work about the statistics and how, Steve, how you'd heard that, you know, you're likely to go on to offend and how that negative information can affect us. So we actually got to do some of the stats here in Canada and then around the world, and it's about a third of people who have actually been offended against would go on to become offenders. But we haven't actually heard, you know, some of the variables that would help people lift up out of that. We also did studies on high-risk youth, and 57% of high-risk youth that are in trouble and in custody have been offended against.
Right.
Instead of actually freeing them up and helping them hear a positive message about God and Jesus and being freed up, we tend to imprison people who have been harmed in their childhood years.
Right.
So we found that,
and that's something we found, Jeff. I used to work when he was alive with Chuck Colson, who founded Prison Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
That's what we found. And the, you know, inmate after inmate, male or female, it didn't matter. It was across gender lines. It was across racial lines, socioeconomic lines, whatever, that by and large, the high percentage of them had been abused in some way, and shame was a part of their life. And it's, you know, it is. And you know the power of it, and you know you working, and it's interesting how you wanted to help, and it's that, you know, you use the positive side of, okay, I know what this feels like to be shamed, so you go into social work because, you know, some people try to outrun it for themselves and try to succeed, or some people just kind of curl up in a ball. You help, and that's the healthy thing. That's that. You know, I admire the heck out of you for doing that, because some people can't get past that, okay, this happened to me, now the world owes me. You went out and made a difference, and that's just remarkable. That's another place where of being set free from shame, when you can help other people.
Yeah, no doubt.
And all praise goes to God on that. You know, God gets everything. God had planned it all. My wife and I have done youth groups, and they ask for our testimony, and we actually share how God used our past to meet one another and help. I work with a lot of people on how stinking thinking actually leads to, and that's Joyce Meyer uses that term a lot, leads to a lot of negative feelings, right? Stinking thinking leads to negative feeling, which then leads to the behavior.
Right.
But God really lifted me up out of it, nobody else other than God and Jesus.
Yeah, to him be the glory. Hallelujah. Well, Steve, seriously, where would we be without the Lord, right? I mean, because try to imagine getting free of what, you know, shame and the kinds of things you've been through apart from your relationship with Christ. I mean, it'd be ridiculous to even try to think about that.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's that Jesus bore that. It's what we were talking about before. How can I truly forgive someone unless I know what it's like to be forgiven? And that's what's missing with a lot of vigilante Christianity, you know, that, you know, this, you know, the thing that so much divisive Christianity, I think, is when people are like trying to, you know, right the wrongs. It's not about righting the wrongs. It's about forgiving the offense. It's about forgiving as you have been forgiven. And I think that's where, and that's why I address forgiveness so heavily in the book, because as long as we're looking, like using Jeff as an example, instead of Jeff, you know, the world owes him, or these people owe him. He's like, no, you know what? It's a fallen world. God, you know, all glory to God for his grace for this, for mankind and for me. God has grace for the person that harmed me, that shamed me, so I need to have grace and forgiveness to extend forward. It's that, the simplest way I can break it down is this, is that as a Christian, you know, I was just speaking at a thing last week, and they said, you know, what would you say as a Christian? A Christian is somebody that treats other people like Jesus treated them and gives other people what Jesus gave them. Jesus treated me with compassion, with patience, with gentleness, you know, the fruit of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And what he gave me was forgiveness. And so as a Christian, I boil it down to one simple thing. As a Christian, I look at the scriptures, I treat people, it is the desire of my heart to treat people like Jesus treated me, and to give people what he gave me. And that's kind of the point of the book is that giving, being able to be free from shame is to embrace forgiveness so right. that you can then give it out. Because as long as you're mad and you're having to get paid back, and there's that vigilante Christianity, it's just never going to work.
Wow, powerful stuff. We can talk about this again when you're in town. We're obviously going to have an opportunity to chat on the radio.
I'd love to, and sit down with you and I'm sure that your listeners, and it sounds like, you know, you have a very loyal group of listeners that you're helping. Again, that's what you're doing. You're helping people because of your life journey, and maybe I can turn the tables on you and interview you.
Uh-oh. Okay. Let's do it, man. Why not? Let's,
amen,
let's live a little risky there. That'd be awesome. Yeah. All right. So obviously people can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all that stuff, and
yep.
Cornerstone. Plus, when you're here with Gary Thomas, you'll have all of your books there. But, Steve, seriously, thank you for opening up. Thanks for being vulnerable. And I know for sure that lives are being changed as a result of your willingness to be used by God in this way. It's not easy, and it's embarrassing, perhaps, or difficult, and maybe not something you would have chosen. But thank you for being an agent for change in the lives of so many people, including me. So thank you.
Oh, man. It's really a privilege and a pleasure. And just as those two guys, as both Mike and Jeff will tell you, there's some freedom in finally coming out from behind that mask, and I don't have to hide anymore.
Amen. Yeah.